So I was going to recap as well, so I'm going to do it anyway. Slightly recap differently. So we've been exploring receptivity, dharmic receptivity, we're calling it. We're calling it dharmic receptivity because of this problem of this word spiritual, which is so easily misunderstood. It sounds so flaky and so much the sort of thing I wouldn't be interested in. So it's good to dispense with that word and replace it by dharmic receptivity. So we started by talking about being receptive to ourselves, particularly receptive to what Buddhism calls Vedana. Vedana is translated as feeling sensation, hyphenated. So it means the basic texture of your experience, the taste, as it were, of your experience. Whether your experience feels somewhere on the pleasant spectrum, somewhere on the unpleasant spectrum, or somewhere in between. Yeah. Very, very important aspect of particularly of meditation is being able to attend to Vedana. It's actually the doorway to depths. If you're going to go deeper in meditation, you need to start to turn towards Vedana. And one of the things I was emphasizing in that first week is that Vedana, actually, the more you think about it, the more you explore it, is not complex, but at least multifaceted. So the thing that I've been reflecting on more and more is the difference between Vedanas of thought and Vedanas of experience. So this is what I was trying to explore. So for instance, I've just come back from an order weekend, a gathering, a UK and Ireland gathering of male order members. And I didn't want to go. I felt quite resistant. Sorry about that, I know it's a terrible scandal, but I didn't want to go. And I definitely thought, no, I definitely don't want to go. And I thought, let me just feel like, no, I definitely don't want to go. You know, it's a fairly long journey. I was going to be sharing a room with Jan of Archer, which I'm sorry to have to tell you all this, but we sometimes snore. I know that will shock you and sort of push him off his pedestal. I mean, it's not horrible. I just thought I'd out you in that way. It's not horrible snoring, but it's still, you know. You know, it was raining. The place we're going to sometimes. Anyway, you know the feeling. You know that uncomfortable thought. But what against, you know, and what actually got me to go was the fact that Vidyadharka had already bought the train tickets. And I come from the Midlands, and you couldn't possibly not go if you, you know, even if I was dead, I would actually go if the train ticket had been bought. So I went, you know, knowing that the train tickets had been bought. But I really enjoyed it, as I so often do, even mostly do. What struck me again about it is it was just that the thought isn't associated with pleasure. So if I thought, what am I going to do this weekend? I'm going to see a film, I'm going to go to a cafe, hopefully do something. Anyway, you know, if I had a thought about what I'm going to do this weekend, going to a retreat with lots of other order members in Herefordshire doesn't feel pleasant as a thought. It's not like coffee and cakes. Sorry about it. I'm not saying it won't for you, but anyway, I've been ordained for a long time. Didn't feel pleasant. The thought wasn't pleasant. But the experience was. But somehow I still thought, yes, but I want a weekend, so I want this great thing, time off. I want free time. And that even that thought of free time is very pleasant, isn't it? It's got a very pleasant vein. So there I was on this retreat, thinking that's all very well, but I do want some free time. That's a nice thought. In the bin, I want to be able to read my book, I want to have free time. Yeah. So, you know, I started choosing about the programme. So we had a talk, and then after the talk we had groups. So I thought, well, after the talk I won't go to the groups because then I can have free time, and I can lie on my bed and read my book and I'm enjoying it. And that's a pleasant thought. Anyway, just before, after the talk, I then ended up going to the group. I don't quite know how I measured, and I was late, but and I really enjoyed the group. Yeah. Actually, and that sort of carried on all the weekend. But what struck me about it is to see how, if I'd just gone with my thought, the Vedana of my thought, I wouldn't have gone in the first place, and I wouldn't have gone to the discussion, or I would have gone out of duty but not gone to the discussion groups. Actually, the discussion groups were one of the highlights of the retreat. this lovely sense of us all talking very openly and interestedly about important things about life, which is what I wanted to be when I grew up. I remember as a child thinking, I want to be sitting around talking about important things. I don't want to sit around talking about rubbish. And there I was doing just that. Yeah. But somehow the thought wasn't pleasant. I thought, you know, having free time was more pleasant. So if I'd just gone with a pleasant thought, I would have missed so much of depth. I wouldn't have gone to the weekend, or I wouldn't have really engaged with the weekend very strongly, and I would have come away feeling actually that wasn't a great weekend. Mainly because I'd gone along with the Vedana of my thought. Do you see what I mean? What I did is notice the Vedana of my thought, notice even the Vedana of not wanting to, but still made a choice. Yeah. And actually, experientially, the weekend and those particular groups were really, really good. Yeah. Really, really good. In fact, at one time, the four of us friends were together, and I really had that lovely sense that one has in one's life occasionally, where this is what my life is for. This is what I'm here for. Actually, we were just doing Qigong, actually, with John of Archer and some friends, and had this lovely sense of, here we are, just friends, and this is what my life is for. This is the whole point. Really lovely feeling, which feels both pleasurable and, in that old-fashioned sense, ennobling. You can have a laugh, and at the same time you feel ennobled by it. So I was struck, you see how one can so easily follow whether your thought is pleasant can take you to do good things, but it also can take you to do things that aren't very good. It can make you miss out on life, or it can make you catch up on life. So do you see how it's so important to make this distinction between the Vedana of thought and the Vedana of experience? So I won't say anymore, because I'm tempted to carry on about that, because I've been so sort of interested by it personally. And then the following week we looked at how we need to be open to the natural world, to art, to objects in the natural world. As I was saying there in the tea break, increasingly my sense is that the world wants us to appreciate it. In fact, that you could think that this being human we're just here just to appreciate things. And that's it. That this being human is meant to be principally an appreciative matter. Of course we should do things, we should go out to help other people, we should make a contribution to life. But more importantly, in a sense, we should just appreciate and express our appreciation and live in appreciation. There's so much to appreciate, especially for us living in the so-called West with its incredible benefits. I mean, we're all living like Renaissance princes in terms of our wealth, you know what I mean? Unimaginable wealth until recently. So much to appreciate. We should all be just sort of dancing on the sand. Compared to most of the world, we're in an incredibly fortunate position. So perhaps we should just, we're here just to appreciate it. But as I said in the way in my tea break, to appreciate you need a state of mind which can be appreciative. And sometimes one wants to appreciate, one can see but cannot feel how beautiful it is. So much of our issue, isn't it? That we can see but not feel how beautiful it is. And what we human beings yearn is to feel how beautiful it is. And that can be your breath, it can be the Malverns that I just came back from yesterday, it can be all those half-drowned fields that we came back through. Nothing's gained by us not appreciating those things. Anyway, so that's what I touched on last week, and Timothy was talking, I thought, very cogently about this attitude of responsiveness, this responsiveness. But I want to come on to the subject of tonight, and obviously the next thing to talk about is appreciating each other. In a sense, that's the real thing, is to appreciate each other. When we talk about appreciating life, mostly what we mean by life is other people, really. when we say we love books or we love languages or we love mathematics, we're using the word love analogously. Love is primarily something you feel for people. That's what it means, really. And when we use it for other things, loving skateboarding or, you know, algebra, difficult to imagine, but I'm just trying to stretch my mind a bit. We're using it by analogy. Yeah? So I want to talk about loving one another. I want to talk about us. I want to talk about appreciating each other. I want to talk about, obviously, being receptive to each other. And I thought I'd start with the Buddha again, because I find that so instructive. Every time I start with the Buddha, I sort of feel clearer about what I'm talking about. So the Buddha gained enlightenment, as you probably all know, 2,500 years ago. According to tradition, sat under a tree, gained enlightenment, which, let's just say, at the moment is just a mystery. I don't know what it is, and nor do you. Okay. He, according to tradition, wondered whether he could possibly communicate this mystery. It was so deep. It is so deep. It goes beyond words, it goes beyond language, it goes beyond yes and no, it goes beyond inside and outside, it goes beyond me and world. So how am I, you can imagine a Buddha for a moment thinking, how can I possibly communicate something that goes beyond the whole framework of ordinary human consciousness? That goes beyond the whole thing of inside and outside, subject and object, me and world. How can I talk about something that's outside that framework? So I imagine that there was just this sort of glimmer of that thought. Something in the text it's put much more crudely, but I would imagine it's just a glimmer of, you know, never going to be able to communicate this. And according to the tradition, a god figure, Brahmasahampati, as he's called, a figure of light, comes down and begs the Buddha to teach. And what I found interesting about that, coming out from that, he's begged, and I think we can think of this god as being a personification of the universe, basically. It's the universe saying, please teach. It's reality saying, please teach. And Brahmasahampati says, according to tradition, there are some with but little dust on their eyes. In other words, some people will be able to see the truth. The best metaphor of really is that, you know, you're a mother with seeing your child just about to put their hand into that candle. You don't think, oh, should I help? You just immediately act. Yeah. So I think really that's the reality of it, but it's dramatized like this as a drama, otherwise, so that you understand it more deeply. Yeah. So it's as if the glimmer of a thought of, can I communicate this, followed by this, you must communicate it. Yeah. But what's striking is that he doesn't decide, so he's asked to teach, the universe is asking him to teach, but he doesn't decide to go to the marketplace. Nobody has, I don't think, has brought this out before, but he could have. He could have just thought, okay, nearest town, where are the lots of people? I just go set up my stall, which lots of Indian teachers did. You know, it was very established then that a spiritual teacher would go to a particular place in the village. There's often a place in the village where you did it. You say, okay, I want to say something, I've got something to teach, I've just had this huge experience, I want to communicate to you. That was very established at the time of the Buddha. So really he could have done that. He could have just walked to the nearest town, as it were, not quite the right word, but the nearest gathering place, and just talked. But he didn't do that. So it's very striking that the first person, people he thought about were his teachers. Those are the first he thought, I could teach them. The reason I find this striking is that it's still tempting to think of the Buddha as a go-it-alone man. That the Buddha went heroically alone, he gained enlightenment on his own, he sort of set off into the jungle alone and found the path himself. It's really just not true. It's sort of true. Actually, if I can get to it, I want to try and say how it's true and not true, which is actually more difficult, but let's just leave it at that for a moment. But He trained with two great teachers at the time. Before he was enlightened, he was taught by two great teachers who were remarkable teachers, and we know the remarkable teachers because those teachers said, actually, you've learned everything I've got to teach you. And both of them said, either join me and let's lead this group of disciples together, or actually you take over. Now, I think that itself shows you that they're great teachers, because that is exquisitely non-egoistic. You know, it would be like me meeting someone who's just come along, does my Life for Attention course, and then has mastered it. And I'd say, actually, you better teach me. I hope I could do that, but you see how you might not want to. You might stand on your pride, which of course is quite dreadful. Religion, spiritual life, whatever we call it, can easily become part of the problem. So we know they're great teachers because they said to Siddhartha, in this case, well, take over, you've got it. Yeah. He learned everything they had to teach him. So he thought first of teaching them. Very, very exquisitely human response. He doesn't think first of going to a town and preaching. There's no thinking of preaching. He thinks of his teachers first. This is the Buddha. Now, he's gone through the great fires of transformation, and he's become the Buddha. He's become a wholly new species unto himself, the like of which has never existed in the world. He even said that, I am a Buddha, later on, I am a Buddha, there isn't anybody else like me, there never has been, here I am. So this is the Buddha thinking, ah, my teachers, I'll teach them. It's exquisitely human. He seemed to then understand, don't know how, by some knowledge that comes with enlightenment, that his teachers were already dead. One of them, it is known that he was quite elderly and died about a year after he met Siddhartha, but he seemed to know that they were already dead. So the next people he thought about were his friends. Again, he didn't decide to go and preach, he thought about his friends. Now his friends had abandoned him. Before he gained enlightenment, before he became the Buddha, his friends, five ascetics as they come to be called, but it's just simpler to think they were his friends. They were, you know, trying to practice something that he was practicing at the time. They were practicing austerities together, so they stopped eating, they, you know, really went for it. And Siddhartha went for it more than anybody else. And there's a point in the story where Siddhartha thinks, tell you what, this isn't getting me anywhere. In fact, according to one tradition, he falls, he sort of faints, rolls down a hill and nearly drowns in the Ganges. And then thinks, actually, I'm on the brink of death and it's got me nowhere. So he basically has some rice pudding. that's how it's translated into English anyway, isn't it? Milk rice, it's called, but actually milk rice is rice pudding. So some of the differences of rice pudding, as they do. When his friends saw him do that, they just thought he's become a softie. He's a wastrel, he's just become a softie. So they just abandoned him. Yeah? So he thinks, oh, I could go and teach them. And he knows where they are. He has this instinct where they are. So he gets up and goes. And he walks. They think the journey must have taken about 2 weeks. Barefoot, he walks from where he was gaining enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. And he walks. He probably would have got an ancient sort of ferry across the Ganges all the way up to Isipatana, where his friends were practicing. He knew they were there. And what's striking again, actually, before I mention that, on the way, he meets a wandering holy man, and this wandering holy man said, there's something about you. You look interesting. What practice do you do, and who's your teacher? Who's your teacher, what practice do you do? And the Buddha said, I'm a Buddha. I have no teacher. I'm as good as it gets. He said it slightly more elegantly than that, but he basically said that I am the Buddha. There is nothing, no one like me in the universe. Yeah? I have no teacher, I have no peer, in other words. Nobody to look up to, I have no peer either. I am the Buddha. And this man says, oh, yeah. He just says, in fact, he says, may it be so, friend. In other words, it's a kind of ancient Indian whatever. Whatever. A sort of ancient Indian talk to the hand, really. And then he literally just wanders off in another way. So that, when you think about that incident, it's quite incredible. Somebody's actually just met the Buddha, not just the Buddha, but they're just gained enlightenment. Literally days before. Incredible opportunity. You know, what an opportunity is that? You've met the Buddha. He's actually said, I am the Buddha. And he would say that with no sense of braggartry because there was no ego. So he would just say it as a fact, like, well, that is a tree. I am the Buddha. Yeah. Incredible meeting. And he just said, whatever. You know, doesn't say that, but anyway. So it shows you that even meeting the Buddha, even meeting the Buddha right after his enlightenment, doesn't mean to say that you pay any attention to him. So do you see how that event in itself alone tells us something very, very important about receptivity? Mm-hmm. That without receptivity, you can literally meet the Buddha days after his enlightenment and say, yeah, I can imagine that. May it be so, which is basically, the actual statement is highly equivocal. It just means, yeah. You know, I'm not saying no, I'm not saying yes, whatever, really. Yeah. Anyway, he carries on his journey, and then five ascetics, his five friends, see him coming. And they say, here he is, you know, the wastrel. And they basically say, here's Siddhartha, here he is again. Let's ignore him. Let's just ignore him. He's just reverted to the life of luxury. He's become a softie. Let's ignore him. So again, you see that there's this attitude of non-receptivity. We've got nothing to tell us. He's left it behind. He chickened out. We're still doing it. He's not as tough as us. He chickened out. Yeah. And that's their intention. But what's striking is that as he gets closer to them, there's something about him that they act against their own will. So they see him coming, and they can't help but go and greet him. They can't help but go towards him and greet him. And somebody gets a seat for him to sit on. Somebody else gets water for him to drink. Somebody else gets him water to wash his feet. Somebody else brings him food. They can't help themselves. And you can imagine that they can't quite understand it. They've just decided to ignore him, and they've all agreed on that. You know how groups can do that? They can sort of turn against somebody. It's a part of what group behaviour is very easily like. Especially if you think, well, we're the tough ones and you're not. So you can imagine them sort of perplexed by their own feeling that they can't help themselves go to the Buddha. And the Buddha says to them, he says, listen, the deathless has been attained. The deathless has been attained. I am not the man that I was. Again, you have to sort of look at the ancient sutras and reimagine it. But he's trying to say, I'm not Siddhartha anymore. Something unimaginable has happened to me. Don't think you're talking to the guy that you left. Don't think that. I'm not the man I was. The deathless has been attained. I have the great solution to the great problem. That's how I've been writing it in my book. The great problem, of course, being death. That is the great problem, capital G, capital P. And what's again interesting is that his friends, one of them says, well, is that possible? I mean, you did go further than us in austerities. You didn't get anything. You didn't gain anything by doing that. How can you have gained something now? And the Buddha bends to talk to them. And again, the sutras say, you know, he taught the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. But the Buddha couldn't have done that. The Buddha, I'm pretty sure, wouldn't have done that. He would have talked to them. He wouldn't have come up with pre-decided formulas and lists. He would have said, he would have tried out this way. And somebody would have said, but hang on, what about this? And, no, I don't mean that. And they, what? And he would have listened to them and talked to them and said, well, try this. And they would have meditated together. It would have been a meeting in that way. They would have been bent. They would have bent their heads together, sitting on the floor, talking, listening, questioning, helping, rethinking, deciding, being even contradicted by the Buddha. The Buddha could be really quite fierce. He might have completely said no to one person, and to another said, it's a bit like that, but let me just tell you a bit more. It would have been like that. And in the midst of that, Kundalini traditionally suddenly understood. He just suddenly saw what the Buddha was getting at. In a moment he saw. Yeah. Gosh, I've gone on much longer than I thought. Anyway, he saw. And of course, as soon as he saw, and by the way, by I mean saw, I mean in that moment he became enlightened. I don't mean he understood the cognitive content of what the Buddha was saying. That's not it at all. Lots of people were taught by the Buddha with the same, as it were, cognitive content and didn't get it, didn't catch it, didn't see it, didn't become enlightened. Kundalini saw. And it's interesting, this metaphor of saw, not understood. Seeing is direct. That's why the metaphor is so often used, I think, in Buddhism, is it's direct. Understanding sounds cognitive. He saw the truth. Yeah? And in that seeing became the truth. And of course, as soon as he saw, the Buddha saw that he saw. That's really what it's getting at. He saw, I've done it. The communication has been made. And he says in the sutras, Kundalini knows. He shouts almost, Kundalini knows, Kundalini knows. Very famous statement. And according to the tradition, the sky fills with angels in that moment. Actually, they're called devas, but basically it means the same thing. They're beings of light, celestial beings. The whole sky fills with beings of light, a tier upon tier. It's quite strikingly similar to pre-Reformation hierarchy of angels. You've just got angels, in this vision, you've got angels sort of starting just above our heads, reaching all the way up to God in the hierarchy of angels. The Reformation got rid of them all and just left human beings and God with this dreadful divide between them. The devas that appeared in the sky are very like this metaphor of the hierarchy of angels. But rather beautifully, what they do is they shout. So they say the deathless has been attained. The wheel of the Dharma has been set in motion. And they shout to the next level of angels above them, who then also shout to the next level above them. So this shout goes up and up, all the way up to the zenith of the universe, except for just, you know, constantly. And what struck me about that, I mean, I think that's very, very important. I think, I've come to think, writing about the Buddha, that the devas are actually much more important than I'd realised. Because the devas seem to, if you read the biography of the Buddha, particularly if you read it in a parable-like, poetic way, which I think is the best way to read it, because those are universal truths, the devas appear when something really important is happening, basically. So the devas first appear when the Buddha decides to leave home. I got very interested in this because the devas don't appear when the Buddha sees the four signs. He sees old age, sickness and death, as it really is, and he sees a wandering holy man, but the devas don't appear then. The devas appear when the Buddha does something about it. And the reason they appear then is because his doing something about it shows it that he's really seen it. Until he acts, until he changes his life, the devas don't appear because they don't know whether he's really seen it. We've all see old age, sickness and death every day, but the devas don't appear to us because we very often don't do anything about it. We carry on watching rubbish on the television, we carry on getting into silly arguments, we carry on in our silly, idle pleasures, which really get us nowhere. We carry on in this perpuncture of our mind. When we act, when we come to a Buddhist centre, when we sit down to meditate, when we go on retreat, when we confess our shortcomings, when we apologise, when we give, when we want to take, then the devas might appear. To the degree we act on our real spiritual instincts, then the devas can appear. So they appear at these key moments. They appear when the Buddha, Siddhartha, cuts off his hair, a symbol of going forth from worldly life, from worldly preoccupations, from a worldly mindset. But never before have they filled the universe. Even at the Enlightenment, a single figure appears that's even got a name, which even makes it particularly important, I think, that they're named. Brahmasahamati appears. Sometimes he's, you know, there's a retinue of gods with him, but primarily it's talked about as a single god figure appears. At the communication of enlightenment, the whole sky fills with them. You see what I mean? That must be saying this is it. This finally is it. It must be saying that this is the completion of enlightenment. This is, if there was a miracle in Buddhism, it's a double miracle. It's the miracle of enlightenment itself, and then it's a double miracle in the miracle of communication of enlightenment. Communicating something that goes beyond subject and object, me and you, self and world, inside and outside, time and space. Something like that has been communicated. The incommunicable has been communicated. Then the sky fills with angels. Even on our own very basic level, and as so often, so below, so above, as below, so above, at our own very basic level, something that we've experienced internally is redoubled when we communicate it. Something else happens. Until we communicate it, and until somebody else understands, our experience is slippery and unfocused and easily seeps away, just doesn't it, so easily. Our moments of vision, our moments of value, just sort of bleed away if we don't communicate them. And even more if we communicate them but we're not understood. People don't get us. Do you know, have you ever had that experience when you're trying to say something, people don't see it? It's very, very painful. When somebody does, it's not just that they've seen it. Do you know what I mean? It's that experience itself fully blossoms, doesn't it? You know what I mean? When somebody else sees what you mean, and even in our ordinary communication, it's not just that they've understood the concept, they get you. They see what you mean. Sometimes, even with our closest friends, they see what I mean more than I do. I'm very fortunate to have very, very good friends in my life. And sometimes, like for instance with Parambandhu, I sometimes say to him, what am I trying to say? And he then tells people. I think, that's what I'm trying to say! He sort of sees what I mean more than I do. It's so pleasant. But not just pleasant, it's sort of... I flourish in that moment. Yeah? I think if that's true now, it's true all the way up to the Buddha. The Buddhahood is completed in its communication. And that's why the sky fills with angels. But I want to say another reason why I think the sky fills with angels, the sky filled with devas, is because I think what the world needs is not lone individuals. However remarkable and inspiring that is, and it is remarkable and inspiring, but whatever, so what? That's great for you, but what about me? What about the world? What the world needs, particularly in this time of the possibility of global catastrophe, the end of capitalism, the breakdown of it feels to me at times that we might be living right at the end of this golden period in history, and it's beginning to tarnish. Gold doesn't tarnish, but you see what I mean, that we're right at the end of an incredible period of wealth, and it's going to crack. Never before has the world needed a new vision, and especially a new community. A community that goes beyond difference, but doesn't deny difference. And you get a little taste of that, don't you? We just come back from the winter retreat, and I was leading a group, and very strikingly, you get people just report in at the start of the group. And one person was a Hebrew scholar sitting next to a plasterer. That's what the world needs, is a community that can bring together those people. We need a community of people that can bring, that have an ideal that goes beyond all difference whatsoever. Gender difference, racial difference, differences of upbringing, of wealth and poverty, of language. Never before has the world needed this so much. It is in grave danger of splitting apart, and there's probably already very strong indicators of that. So do you see, in that moment when the Buddha communication is such an easy word, but in that moment where the incommunicable was communicated, then this possibility of this new community arose. And that's why the sky filled with angels, because a possibility of a community of men and women who actually have gone beyond being men and women arose in the world. The Buddha, you know, classically is still sort of biologically male, but he's not psychologically male. He's not psychologically female. He's not psychologically a bit of both. You can't say what it is, but he doesn't identify with gender masculinity or gender femininity or anything in between. He's a new species unto himself. So then that is, somebody else gets that, becomes enlightened. What then happened is that this happened just at the start of the rainy season, according to tradition, and those five friends of the Buddha, much better to think of it like that, talked to him, meditated together, were on retreat together, basically, for the months of the rainy period. The end of the rainy period, all of those five men have become enlightened. Yeah. And in one and another sutra, you get these enlightened disciples of the Buddha, and quite often they want to say, the Buddha is more than us. He's the Buddha. And the Buddha would say, no, your enlightenment is the same as mine. It's the same as mine. Your mind is like my mind. And the Buddha would know that your and mine, we don't really mean that. You can't say what the Buddha would mean by yours and mine, but he wouldn't mean anything remotely like we mean it. He knew that we're only just saying that, it doesn't really mean anything. So you end up with a community of enlightened disciples who then go off and teach. Yeah? And that's why the sky fills with angels. It doesn't fill with angels at the enlightenment, it fills with angels when it's communicated. So I think, I'm sorry if I've gone on, I wanted to try and say a little bit more coming down from that, if I can. So clearly you've got two really important elements just to start off with. One is, quite obviously, somebody has made a great spiritual breakthrough. On our level, we can just say that someone's a bit more spiritually advanced. You need that. You can't not have that. It's not just a group of five people working it out between them. Somebody inevitably leads. It might not be somebody, it might be some people lead. But nearly always that's true. My background is in the arts, and it's very true in the arts. I'm very inspired for a long time by the Florentine Renaissance, incredible flowering of genius. And it was led by, effectively, Michelangelo and Leonardo, who were very competitive. But it created around them an incredible flowering of talent, which we would have heard much more of were it not for Leonardo and Michelangelo. For instance, Michelangelo wrote wonderful poetry. We would have heard much more about that had he not done even better pictures. There are wonderful painters around those men, but we don't hear them because Michelangelo and Leonardo are so incredible. Similarly around the Buddha. You probably haven't heard of Kundanya. You won't know many of the Buddha's disciples. It's just because the Buddha himself is so remarkable. So you have somebody who's deeper in life than you, who's seen into life more deeply than you. And of course, on our own level, of course, that's much more nuanced. It's exemplified here by enlightened consciousness and non-enlightened consciousness. Very, very straightforward. What you have there is a simple verticality. The Buddha's up here and I'm here. Very, very straightforward verticality. Probably like you've never had that simple verticality again, in that pure sense. But nevertheless, there is a vertical principle in life. There must be, otherwise we couldn't have any idea of human growth. So if you've been meditating for a while and you think you're already a little bit more wiser, kinder, less selfish than you were as a teenager, that's a vertical principle. You know what I mean? Nobody thinks, I hope, that actually I'm just pretty much the same as I am a teenager, I'm no more, you know, whatever than that. Yeah? So there's a principle of verticality. And you see that can be related to your own life. I'm more developed than I was. Even if it's that's rather nuanced. You're not probably more developed than you are in all areas, but you probably are generally a bit more developed than you were, certainly as a teenager. But it also is in relationship to other people. So I've got friends in my life who I assure, you can't really be sure, but I experience them as being vertical in relation to me. I look up to them. I really want to as well. That's secondary, but I do want to. I think that human beings have a very deep urge to look up to people. It's an urge that we need to educate because it can go very badly wrong. People can look up to charlatans. People can look up to fakes. It's an urge that can go badly wrong. I've often noticed people's judgment about who to look up to is very immature. One of the things I would say about myself is my capacity to judge people in the best sense has improved. I have a clearer, more objective sense of who to look up to. Still probably problematized. I can be bamboozled by clever words or whatever, but generally speaking I have a much surer sense of that. And I really need to have friends in my life I can look up to. I want that. I think I need it. I think we all need it. I think a lot of the issues for us is because we've lost any real sense of that. Partly it's been betrayed. It's been betrayed by authority, which has said we should look up to it, but then behaved in a way that can't be looked up to. It's also been slightly rather betrayed by this modern desire to pull everybody down to the same level. We're so keen to pick on people's faults now and say that they're the same as us that we won't allow them to have strengths. There's something really quite despicable about our egalitarianism, our desire to make people smaller than they are, a sort of naysaying. Understandable, but it becomes rather despicable. So there's that verticality, that the principle of the vertical, but then there's also this receptivity, the principle of receptivity to that verticality, to the Buddha in this case, because he'd already met somebody who wasn't receptive, completely wasn't. He's like an archetype, he's like the patron saint of non-receptivity. So if you want, I think he has actually got a name, I can't remember what it is, but he is named in the sutras. So we could actually make him the patron saint of non-receptivity, of oikishness, thick-headedness. Anyway, I'll paint a picture of him one day as a patron saint. Probably none of us are quite as unreceptive as that, but many of us, much of the time, are unreceptive. Partly because we're not in conditions in which we can be receptive very often. Life doesn't allow for it. Partly because of our complexities around authority and so on. But if we're not receptive, we won't learn. Simple as that. Of course, if we are receptive, we might be receptive in a slightly wrong way. We might get it slightly wrong. We might give over ourselves. We might put people on pedestals. Very dangerous thing to do because you usually end up kicking that person. Sometimes people have done that with me. I feel like saying, can we sort of jump past the pedestal bit and the kicking because you're not on a pedestal bit and just get back to like, how are you and how are you? And sort of simple human relationships. So we need to be receptive. And we need, I think we need to risk that. It is a risk, actually. It can go wrong. And it has gone wrong. It has gone wrong at times in our movement. But without it, with it, certain individuals, even at times with Bhante, our precious teacher, but without it, you cannot learn. You will remain an ignoramus. And that is not ennobling. However pleased one is of it, it's never ennobling. Yeah. Being receptive doesn't imply any kind of flaccidity or silliness or lack of intellectual thought or even lack of criticism. The most receptive people I know are both also very intelligent and also very self-willed in a way. They're quite happy, healthy human beings. They're able to be receptive because they don't feel threatened. Actually, receptivity is a sign of psychic health. If you can't be receptive to people you look up to, it's because you feel insecure, really, because you're frightened that your sense of yourself isn't strong enough. So perhaps that's telling you that, and perhaps one that's an important lesson to learn. Yeah? So those are two primary things, aren't there? There's the principle of the vertical, and if there isn't that principle, spiritual life is a fantasy. That's why it's so important. If it's just us and the Buddha, which ends up frankly being us and this gilded figure, or us in a picture, then it might be a fantasy, mightn't it? The Buddha might never have existed. Some people will even say that he didn't. It could just be a nice idea. That spiritual enlightenment is a nice idea, nice to have. The idea of a path to enlightenment, lovely, it's very inspiring, but it could be a fantasy. Unless you see it lived out in actual human beings in the epoch that you're alive, i.e. people that you can meet, the whole thing could be a fantasy. Nice ideas, lovely phrases, lovely teachings, but tell you what, no one makes any progress. Yeah? So without that verticality, human verticality particularly, you destroy Buddhism. There isn't such thing as Buddhism. There's just books. And nobody really loves books. They only love people. Then you have this principle of receptivity to that, without which no means exists, without which no learning can take place. And yes, that's risky. And one of the counterpoints to that risk is the friendships with people of the same level as you. So I want to finish, I was going to say more, but I want to finish with saying a bit of that. So we need to be receptive people who have more spiritual spirit experience than we have. We need to be intelligently receptive in a grown-up, I'm fine as I am, thanks very much way, and if I think that your advice isn't very good, I won't take it. Or even if I think it is good, I might decide not to take it anyway, and that's fine, and there's no withdrawal of love. A friend of mine once went to Subhuti, actually, and said, here's my predicament, what should I do? And Subhuti said, I think you should do that. And my friend said, I think that's right. I'm not going to do it. Okay? But that's perfectly honourable. It's been perfectly honourable. The friendship remained intact and has remained intact all this time. But one of the other vital ingredients, which the story doesn't bring out so much, because as soon as you have the Buddha, his light shines above everybody else. But it can't have been literally that it was just the Buddha talking to these five friends and everything went through the Buddha. I'm leading a discussion group at the moment, well, I'm not at the moment because I'm doing this seminar, but I've got this men's discussion group and I'm leading it. But it's not like the discussion group, everything is what do you think of this, Majjhavanda, I say that and then say, you know, Nico says, yeah, but Charlie, you're, and, you know, and Toby says, oh yeah, but, you know, everybody says things to each other. Actually, a lot of the value of the group happens just before and just after, or just in the tea break. Sometimes all the men's group I'm leading, they're all, you can see them, I can see them still by the door, talking to each other. I think it must have been like that, except for it was a Buddha. But it can't have been literally that everything went through him. He would have gone off and meditated. They would have said, what do you think of it? Did you get it? You know, You can imagine all that. That's what human beings need to do, isn't it? Did you understand that? Not at all. What was it? You know, that's what human beings do, and that's how you learn, isn't it? You need people around you who are friends. You can say, "I didn't get it." No, I didn't either. Let's. Why don't you ask him? Because I can't. What? You know, they. let me just ask you another question. That's what friends do, yeah. So, you call that kind of peer friendships, that the incredible value of peer friendships. What we need, I think, is a first of all this great community, this Maha community that was started in that moment when the Buddha taught his five friends. He created in that moment the possibility of a transcending community of men and women who, by practicing the Holy Dharma, go beyond me and therefore go beyond all difference of age, race, gender, sexuality, and so on. That's the first thing we need. Then we need, within that, a principle of verticality. For that principle of verticality to exist, we need receptivity, without which no means exists. For that principle of receptivity to be at its most active and valuable, you need friends, you need peer friends. Yeah? Within those friends, you particularly need friends of your the same gender. You particularly need friendships which are less polarized, less complex, less given to projection. It's not that you can't have friendships across the gender, but you particularly need friendships which it's quite straightforwardly a friendship. Yeah? Now, even friendships between gender, within the gender, can be complex, I know that. And their sexuality can be involved in that even. But you need something within that greater community. There needs to be pockets of really close friends. Like Subhadramati and I are good friends. We've been friends for many, many years. But I also know that Subhadramati has got very close women friends, and I've got very close men friends. And that actually makes our communication more straightforward, not less. It wasn't always straightforward when we were young. Anyway, that's another. I remember that conversation. Anyway, we were. I fell in love with her for a bit. Don't I? I've admitted it. She's very, very charismatic. Anyway, she's good. That was a long time ago. Okay, so that's what I wanted to explore more and more, but that's what I wanted mainly to say, that first of all you've got this community that overcomes, transcends all difference. I feel more and more that that is what the world needs, not lone geniuses. We've had it with lone geniuses. We need men and women who can communicate their deepened experience so that other people get it and try and deepen their own experience. We need, therefore, this vertical dimension in life. We need to bring it back, if necessary. We need to escape this sort of pseudo-egalitarian where we pull people down to size because we can't bear anyone being better than us. We need to get rid of that. We need to naysay that, actually. We need to cultivate a genuine receptivity, intelligent, grown-up receptivity. And we need friends, especially friends of our own gender. That we can be friends, not mates with. I know men better, of course, than women, because I've never been a woman, so I've never had friendships with my own gender. Anyway, never mind. The great danger for men is to just become mates. It's how men prevent friendship arising, is they become mates. What they usually do is they lean on their women. They go to their women to talk about their more vulnerable feelings, their difficult feelings for comfort, and then they go to men for, you know, silly stories about their sexual conquests and so on. That's what men tend to easily get into, and more subtle versions of that. Being a mate for a man is the inoculation of friendship. It inoculates you against friendship. I don't know the issues of women. Subhadramati might mention it next week. Okay, so that's all we've got time for tonight. Thank you very much.